are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, May 9th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Sam slash Michael slash gang Thursday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Lee Phillips and Michael Rozorski on the People's Republic of Walmart. In some ways, does the central planning of Walmart prove that there's nothing innately wrong with central planning? Interesting interview that Sam conducted with these guys.
Dunking on Von Mises.
Dunking on Von Mises. And is Walmart, that great global capitalist predator, inadvertently making a case for some form of socialism? That's a fascinating interview. Donald Trump Jr. has been subpoenaed. House panel approves a contempt for Barr, even as Steve Mnuchin, okay, is refusing to release Donald Trump's taxes. The New York State Senate passes a bill allowing Congress to get those very same taxes. Juan Guaido deputy Edgar Zamorano towed in a car to prison in a Venezuelan crackdown, which sort of makes some sense as these people have been trying to instigate a coup for several weeks. H.R. McMaster says the public is fed war weariness narrative that hurts U.S. strategy.
Good.
This is great. Again, we're still at war in Afghanistan. That's longer than World War II. We're still killing lots of civilians there. Speaking of U.S. strategy, the EU rejects Iran deal ultimatum and regrets U.S. sanctions as sane people in the world scramble to avert the war drums being pushed by Pompeo, Bolton, and Trump. AOC is partnering with Bernie Sanders on her first major piece of legislation in Congress. This is on capping credit card interest. Great bill, potentially very important political signal. And Bernie and AOC have worked together to back striking Uber and Lyft drivers. I hope everybody backed them yesterday as well. Election results pouring in from South Africa, where it looks like ANC, the African National Congress, has crossed the 50% threshold that it will need to govern without a coalition and registering some confidence in the leadership of Cyril Ramaphosa. Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes says it's time to break up Facebook as the obvious policy answers continue to present themselves, and potentially a script for a second Aaron Sorkin vehicle. Social Network Part 2, The Breakup. Denver voters approve the decriminalization of magic mushrooms. In fact,
hell yeah,
this is a very important policy area. People should absolutely have the freedom to explore their own consciousness. That's actually a very exciting initiative. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Sam is on the road, or just not here. I don't even know where he is. He could be sleeping, which actually, as much as I give Sam a hard time for being the four-day-a-week man, because, you know, he gives us a hard time for, like, missing a day, I will say he probably should get more sleep. So I hope he's getting more
sleep.
I hope he's getting sleep. Like, legit, the man should get more sleep. And you can tell when he's just like, and you would define your politics as.
Oh, my God. I'm such a sleep monster. I feel so bad for him when I could tell he got, like, 0 hours of sleep.
Do you have an easy time falling asleep, though?
No.
Yeah, I don't have an easy time. Falling asleep is a challenge for me, too. I wonder if that part of it probably is this job.
Definitely.
The key is to just game until like 2 in the morning, and then you'll fall asleep immediately when you go to bed.
See, I can't. I need to slowly start putting away all electronics and going towards like books or taking a walk or whatever. But as long as like, yeah, it's, the phone is really a cursed thing. All right, let's start with this piece of sound. This woman, Rachel Campos Duffy, I'm totally unfamiliar with her. My understanding is that she's part of some horrible couple that got their start on reality television, and now they promote, you know, extremist propaganda, and her husband's in Congress. Is that true? So this has been a problem for right-wingers for a very long time. Because whether you're Ayn Rand or whether you're the Fox and Friends couch or whether you're, you know, obviously Mitch McConnell or Donald Trump or the Koch brothers or Paul Ryan or whoever, you are there to valorize wealth at the expense of all other, not only human values, but just literally human attributes. There's nothing else to concern yourself with in life and certainly nothing else to respect. And I think human nature is a complex thing. It's not as if we're born angels and then sort of corrupted by society, but we're also not born monsters. So human beings are complex. And one of the ways that we've managed intergenerationally, and I kind of feel like Jordan Peterson now, but I think it is actually true, is that we do, especially to kids, we tell stories where we try to instill and shape values and ways of responding to the world. So conservatives have a hard time because a lot of children's stories emphasize things like not being a prick. And if you're Rachel Campos Duffy and the, wow, I'm just looking at them in a freeze frame, just the ever effervescent Fox and Friends couch, this not only is a problem for your sort of the spiritual death you're promoting across the world in terms of valorizing wealth at all costs at all times, it really is borderline communist conspiracy.
Rachel, let's ask you a little bit about this op-ed. And the headline on Fox News is, "Fighting Socialism Starts with the Little Red Hen." What are you talking about there?
Well, the topic is really that if you're not talking to your kids about socialism, and this is the battle in our country right now, free enterprise and capitalism versus socialism, that's the battle. And if you're not talking to your kids about it, somebody is. And it's not just in the textbooks and the curriculums at your kids' school. These messages, and the, I call them the merchants of socialism out there in the culture,
ironic.
They start very young. Our cartoons denigrate competition. There are all kinds of children's books out there. Look at the movies. I mean, when's the last time you saw a successful entrepreneur not be the villain in a movie for your kids?
Isn't Iron Man? Isn't
yeah,
he,
yeah. First
he's
of
an
all,
arms
Iron,
dealer.
Iron Man is literally an arms dealer. But I think what this goes back to, and this movie's already really pretty old at this point, was the Lego movie that came out several years ago. And the villain in the Lego movie is a soulless CEO who legitimately looks like Mitt Romney. Like, I have no doubt, like, there was a Romney in the storyboard. So they're still feeling very sore over that.
In a movie for your kids or even for adults. So there are lots of subtle messages out there promoting socialism. But the good news for parents is that we are our first and most influential teachers for our children. So we have more influence than they do, but we have to have these conversations and we have to start early. And I say one of the best books to start with is The Little Red Hen. It's the ultimate book about hard work and personal responsibility, deferred gratification, all the things that it takes to really achieve the American dream in America.
What do you tell your kids about socialism? Because I know you have some older kids. You have 8 children, and I know some of them are in high school. What do you teach them?
Jesus.
Well, the first thing you want to do is listen to them because they're getting a lot of these messages, and you know, in class discussions, in their textbooks. But I say, Ainsley, you got to use all the time you have in the car, dinner time. If you have a small business, bring your kids to your work and show them what you do and how a business works. Tax preparation time. Tell them how many months a year you work to give money to the government before you actually get to keep a dollar of it. A lot of times kids don't know these things.
Tell them about how
to teach them.
How if you are even a middle income or upper middle income business owner, you're paying a not insignificant portion of your income in taxes, because there are people that are millionaires and billionaires and global corporations that are literally paying nothing. Maybe you could tell them that. But I'm sure you'd prefer to exhaust your kids with repeating the little red hen over and over again. You imagine these poor kids are in the car and their parents start like blabbing at them about Venezuela and like trying to like disinstill basic human empathy. Like you see a homeless person and the kid has like the appropriate moral response to be worried. And you're like, no, I'm sure that this person has totally messed up their lives.
That person could have worked harder. That person could have
worked harder. And if you're worried about them, you know, it's a liberal who gave them a housing voucher. That's why they're homeless. You want to read the little red hen again? This is also another thing I'm sure that would really upset them. And this is, of course, the classic PBS children's cartoon, Barney. This is an example of really kind of a prototypical communist society and kids having a pretty good time.
Did you like the ride, Barney?
Now, did she charge Barney for
that
ride?
Yeah, I was going to say, now did she say, thank you, Barney, please write me 5 stars, that'll be $10. Now I need to go to my janitorial job at the school in order to earn my keep. Because again, that literally is the Dickensian dystopia that these people on Fox News want for all non-oligarch children. They want to eat them out of life so that ever, ever shrinking margins can go to ever fewer people.
Wow, look at all their cool stuff. Mr. Boyd's gonna be surprised when he sees how many toys we've brought.
There's a bunch here already.
Yeah, it looks like lots of people brought toys to give away.
I think it's nice to share with other kids who don't have any.
Me too.
Wrong.
Disgusting.
Look at this.
Disgusting. Jeez. Those other kids, what you need to do is like that classic Eddie Murphy routine where Eddie said, we should have cut this. But the right answer, according to Rachel Campos and Duffy, as I understand her, Fox and Friends, is, and Eddie did a great routine where when the ice cream truck came, there was always one kid that couldn't afford ice cream. And all the other kids circled around him with their cones and said, he can't afford it. He can't afford it because his father is an alcoholic and he's on the welfare. He's on the welfare. That's what kids should be doing. And learning, according to Fox and Friends and Rachel Campos Duffy. But this is the Barney world right here.
52% of American millennials would like to live in a socialist or communist America.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Cheers. So
it's good.
So basically, like, these kids learning, like, the most basics of moral development is a strategic threat to these people's goal to return to some type of fusion of, like, you know, sort of Blade Runner meets the 17th century.
Yes, indeed. Boo. Yes, indeed. Hiss.
Exactly.
Wait till she sees what's in the Bible.
Oof. Jesus was legitimately, like all holy books, you can read whatever you want into it, but really one area where there is not super a lot of room for interpretation is Jesus on wealth policies. Got he had it. A lot of message discipline. Yeah.
And seeing her with her army of budding conservatives just makes me want to have an army of red diaper babies to fight them.
Who knows, though? Maybe her kids might turn out cool, though.
I hope so, because I worry about kids adopted into families like that. It's concerning to me a little bit.
We'll keep an eye on them.
Mom! 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 Why did you do that to me?
One of today's sponsors is Skillshare, and anyone who goes to skl.sh/majorityreport3 is going to get, I should say that again, skl.sh/majorityreport3 is going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library of super quality online courses and tutorials. Skillshare is a vibrant online learning community that offers courses on everything from design, video editing, photography, business, technology, cooking, and much more, and everything in between. There are Skillshare courses for everyone. You'll have no problem finding courses that will be useful to you in both your personal and professional life. Whether you want to sharpen your skills with something you already love doing, or you want to learn to do something totally new, Skillshare has you covered. They have courses for entrepreneurs, courses on computer coding, web development, personal nutrition, learning new languages, Photoshop, you name it. I am finally going to reattempt to pick up a second language. It's one of my great regrets and shames in life. I did pick up some Turkish when I studied there, but I wasn't able to retain it. I tried to study Mandarin once and just didn't have the discipline for it. I think I might start closer to home and learn either Spanish, but potentially Portuguese, because I cover Brazil a lot. You can get 2 entire months free to access every single course offered by Skillshare by going to sklsh/majorityreport3. Just think of everything you'll have at your fingertips for 2 whole months. That's sklsh/majorityreport3. And we've put a link underneath this video if you're watching on YouTube, https://. And the show is also brought to you by Simple Habit. The Majority Report is being supported by Simple Habit. Simple Habit is a mobile device that provides a massive and diverse library of 5-minute guided meditations. Matt was just talking about hopping on the train himself. And the Majority Report audience can try Simple Habit totally free for an entire week when you go to simplehabit.com/majority. There's a growing body of scientific evidence. Look at Richie Davidson's neuroimaging work at the University of Wisconsin as but one of many examples. It can improve your health. It's showed to potentially even improve empathy and other vital emotional skill sets. Simple Habit has over 2,000 guided meditations specifically designed for different parts of your day and just about anything you might be dealing with in life. They have guided meditations for mindfulness, meditations for anxiety, for depression, when you're having trouble falling asleep, meditations for when you're wanting to overcome procrastination, or when you're having something important going on at work, meditation designed for parental units, for parents. They have meditations made specifically for when you wake up, on your lunch break, or when you've just gotten home from work, or when you're going to bed. I, as everybody knows, I've had different types of meditation practices for quite some time now, mainly mindfulness, sometimes mantra practices. And as I mentioned earlier, sleep is difficult, and I've been using this app to help me fall asleep, and it's been incredibly effective. I like the range of options, just even that there are so many different situations where meditation might be relevant, and I like how easy it is to use. Different people are trying to accomplish different things with meditation, and Simple Habit is able to cater to just about everyone, regardless of what their goals are with meditation or how much past experience they have with meditation. The variety of guided meditations on Simple Habit is what sets it apart. Simple Habit just won the 2008 Google Play Award for best-selling app. It's available for iOS, Android, and web browser. And the Majority Report audience can try it now, can try it for free for a week by going to simplehabit.com/majority. If you're watching on YouTube, we've put a link in the video description. We're going to take a brief break, and we're going to come back with Sam's interview on the People's Republic of Walmart, and then we'll take you to the fun half.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Lee Phillips, a science writer, and Michal Rozwarski. He is a writer and a union researcher, and they are the co-authors of The People's Republic of Walmart, How the World's Biggest Corporations Are Laying the Foundation for Socialism. Lee, Michal, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
Great to be here.
So, all right, let's start with this. Michal, maybe you can start, or Lee, whichever one of you feels most comfortable. But this basically starts with a failed assumption by our good friends Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich von Hayek, who felt that central planning, impossible. And therefore, we need a fully market-based system. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. In a way, the book isn't really organized about sort of a big thesis. It's organized around an idea, that idea of economic planning, of rationally deciding about production and distribution rather than letting, as you said, you know, market relations dictate both. And it's a way of bringing up to the present the calculation debates of the 30s and the 40s that starred people like Mises and Hayek on the right versus a sort of coterie of left-wing economists on the other side arguing for planning, and bringing it up to date in light of both developments in sort of information technology, but historical developments as well, and in light of the sort of fact that we don't really talk about and that the right doesn't like to talk about, is that there is lots of economic planning that already exists in today's society on humongous scales. And it happens in the Walmarts and the Amazons, also, you know, the NHS and other places in our economy. And it puts a lie to at least a good chunk of the calculation debate, which from the right was premised exactly on that fact, that this kind of huge scale of calculation is impossible. So we already plan, but we could be doing it very differently, democratically.
Lee, elaborate on that notion of just like, what are we talking about when we say we're planning? I mean, what, like, what does that mean? And I guess maybe the best way to start is, like, you know, tell us a little bit about Walmart in that respect, because maybe it's too hard. Maybe it was too hard 100 years ago, 80 years ago, to imagine something so large being so centrally planned. But give us why is Walmart an example of this?
Well, so even though Walmart exists within a sea of prices external to its doors, internally it's entirely planned. So there isn't an internal market there. There aren't, you know, the managers don't tell, you know, don't sort of have an auction to see who's going to bid the lowest to be paid to move one box to from one shelf to another shelf. It doesn't use market mechanisms internally. Now, this is very interesting because, I mean, probably the strongest argument that the right has ever mounted against the left, against the idea of socialism, is that it is very, very difficult to plan at scale. One of the aspects within the calculation debate was the challenge that, you know, across the course of the supply chain, there's an infinitude of variables. And the price signal in the market basically compresses that, or encapsulates that, or most of that. And to replace the price signal with non-market mechanisms, with planning, would require basically an army of bureaucrats to both discover all that information and then to calculate it. You know, this is actually a really, really good argument, but the problem here is that if the argument is that planning at scale with and you know, any larger than a small number of variables is impossible, then Walmart shouldn't work, because Walmart is this vast internally planned economy on the scale of if it were a country, you know, it'd be a Sweden or a Switzerland.
All right. That's the thing that people need to understand, that we're talking about a massive, massive enterprise. Michal, what makes Walmart an economy as opposed to an enterprise within an economy? And then I want to talk about that notion of being able to plan. Or maybe we should start actually with that. Let's start with that notion of being able to plan, because I just want to tease this out for people who don't sort of, spend a lot of time with these concepts. The idea that the right has is that we don't know where the equilibrium or how to make something this large function. It's almost trial and error. And the market basically is a process of trial and error in a way, is that, and naturally comes to a point of equilibrium. Is that the theory? And then talk about why internally in Walmart it's an economy as opposed to like just an enterprise.
Sure. So yes, in a way that's the theory. I mean, the funny thing is that theory isn't borne out in practice in so many ways. We have so many ways that the, you know, so many market distortions and externalities, and that's things that the left talks about all the time, you know, from monopsony in the labor market, creating wages that are, you know, quote unquote, too low at equilibrium, to things like, you know, the price of dealing with climate change not being included in the price of fossil fuel. So even that image of a self-correcting sort of equilibrating market is one that, you know, as the right likes to say, works in theory, but fails in practice. And that's part of the, but regardless, the point that they were making is exactly that the market is this mechanism that's able to sort of correct and take all of this information and compute it. It's funny today to read sort of Hayek in the 40s, where he talked almost mystically about prices being action at a distance, which, you know, in the age of smartphones and telecommunications networks spanning the whole globe, it sounds kind of quaint. You know, we have action at a distance in our pockets on scales kind of unimagined by Hayek. And it also speaks to the sort of to the way that his political project in a way worked, that our imaginations have been foreclosed after decades of neoliberalism, and these debates that we used to have in the 30s and 40s about how we organize the economy, how we organize social life, sort of in a much bigger way, not whether we, you know, tinker with this aspect or that aspect. They used to be really, really live debates. And then to bring that up to the present, to your question about Walmart, I mean, something like an organization like Walmart starts to show that these debates should have currency today, because Walmart is much more than just, you know, a store where you go and buy products. Lee can speak to this a bit more too, but they've basically, when you look at sort of operations research and economic research around Walmart, they've firmified, that's the word these researchers often use, the entire supply chain. So they've really integrated more and more and more of the supply chain into something that begins to resemble one firm rather than a series of sort of contracts between suppliers. And it's based on, again, these operations researchers, you know, not known for lefty political views, focus in on the aspect of trust. First, you know, first of there are a lot of, you know, there's some pretty cutthroat means to get people into these kinds of networks. But then there's trust that guarantees that the information within these chains is actually reliable and correspondent to reality. And it's not just the price signal passing things along, but what starts to look like, you know, a sort of planned supply chain that goes further and further closer to the source of our product. So Walmart is, you know, is a big production distribution chain, really.
Lee, so I mean, is that what we mean by an economy? I mean that we have all these players there. They basically come into the family. They may be, you know, specifically Walmart, or they may be, an enterprise that is like exclusively deals with Walmart, right? And so is that? I mean, what is it that makes it? What is it that we're looking for that makes it? I mean, I can see the size of it, right? But we wouldn't necessarily describe it as an economy if it was just one massive store, right? Or would we? I mean, what is it? What elements is it? Is it the logistics? Is it the supply, the purchasing and the producing? I mean, what are the actual elements that make it an economy? And how is that different from, say, like even like, you know, I don't know, the U.S. military on some level?
Right, right. Okay, so, well, I mean, why not describe it as an economy? I mean, it isn't a national economy. It's not a nation state. It certainly doesn't manufacture and produce all possible items in an economy required by our society. But also no nation state does that. I mean, the only nation that attempts that, I don't think they really do attempt this, or what we could call autarky, trying to produce everything in a single society, would be North Korea. But you know, all national economies produce a certain amount of goods and services, while other countries produce other goods and services. So, it's sort of a semantic discussion whether it is a country for sure. Nevertheless, the important thing for us here is that if it is this very strong argument from the right within the calculation debate that you should not be able to plan at this great scale. And what we really wanted to do was use traditional, you know, public sector counter examples, although we do that with the National Health Service in the UK as one of the examples in our book. We wanted to use some, like, the best example that capitalism had to throw at us. You know, Walmart is the largest company in the world. Amazon is this marvel of logistics and distribution and prediction. So we wanted to use the best examples from capitalism. And the other thing is that often the argument is, even from the right, may even concede that, okay, well, maybe you can plan some large entities like iron production or coal mining, because, you know, with a very small number of inputs, and so that's possibly you could do that, but you certainly couldn't plan something along the lines of consumer items, because there are just so many more variables involved. So that was another reason that we wanted to use Walmart and Amazon as our prime examples, was, again, this is, you know, these are very much consumer facing entities.
And so where the idea would be that a socialist government could adopt essentially these strategies or not even necessarily these strategies of a Walmart, but Walmart is almost a proof of concept on some level that you can have an enterprise this big and it can provide goods to this many people.
Well, planning.
Go ahead, Micha.
I'll say that yes, exactly. It is. I mean, in the book, that's the role. It sort of plays a kind of proof of concept. The importance is the scale and the degree to which prices matter less within that sort of, as you said, within that family, within Walmart, and the use of all of that extra price information that, again, some of the computing power enables. I mean, the flip side, and economists have sometimes talked about, you know, they don't really like to look inside the black box of the firm because it has this sort of planning element that goes against so many of the traditional arguments. But when they have called it, called Walmart or other large companies islands of conscious power, which is a phrase from an early collaborator of Keynes. What we also say in the book is that it's equally important to remember Noam Chomsky's sort of twist on that phrase, which is islands of tyranny. So they're a proof of concept for large firms, can be a proof of concept for just sort of the fact that you can plan and that the market isn't the be-all and end-all of social organization. But the way that they do plan is technocratic, highly authoritarian. In a way, you know, if the Soviet Union is the traditional kind of reference point for planning for a lot of people and the bogeyman of the right, we kind of want to smear and tar Walmart and Amazon with that same brush, that these are basically, you know, private fiefdoms. They're dictatorships internally. They also use authoritarian planning within a capitalist system. You know, it looks different than the USSR in many ways, but it is a place where democracy goes to die, where we spend so much of our daily lives, and that's, you know, a place where what the boss says goes, and it's a very particular kind of authoritarian planning that happens under capitalism. So it's a proof of concept, but its application for the left in terms of what it would look like in daily life and what is what a full expression of sort of democratic planning would look like is limited in that respect.
Well, I want to just put a pin in that idea that it's also that it arguably is a cautionary tale on some level, right? And swing around to just if you and I don't know who is better suited to discuss this, Lee or Michal, but Walmart didn't have to act like Walmart. They could have acted like Sears, right? And Sears is
right.
Was different how?
So when Edward Lampert took over Sears, known as Crazy Eddie, because he was such an admirer of the objectivist quote unquote philosopher Ayn Rand, that such a believer in the free market that when he took over and looked in the box that was Sears, to see that it was entirely internally planned. He basically, thought that Sears was communist and horrified by this notion. He thought that he could quote unquote fix Sears by introducing an internal market mechanisms within the company. So that what this meant was that different departments would compete against each other, and he thought this would result in greater efficiencies and greater profitability for the company overall. But what ended up happening instead was that because these different departments were competing against each other, they were no longer interested. They had no incentive anymore to share information. Information became proprietary and secretive. This resulted in massive duplication, irrationalities such as the tools department getting their wares on the front page of the Mother's Day flyer because it was more of an interest to them. But even though that was undermining the profitability overall of the company, what's really sort of tantalizing about that is how similar that is to a market society as a whole, where each individual enterprise, each individual company is engaged in an activity that's rational for itself, to maximize its profitability, but that undermines the viability of the society as a whole.
I mean, that's the central tenet of that libertarianism, right? I mean, each person acting in their own best interest gives you a better outcome to the whole. And if you ever needed a comparison of that, of two similarly situated, I guess, economies, if you will, Walmart shows you that that's not the case, or that you can do it a different way. And Sears shows you the problems of doing it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Well, so, how is Amazon different from Walmart? Where does Amazon add into this equation?
In some ways, it's just another example. I mean, it's the main thing is, taking that use of sort of information technology to the next level and taking the level of sort of calculation or taking the calculation problems that it's solving sort of to the next level, whereas, Walmart only has to get goods to X thousand stores. Amazon is getting goods to, X millions or tens or hundreds of millions of individual consumers. So you can see how the calculation problems in terms of resource use and all of that become exponentially greater. And in some ways, what Amazon shows is that while some of these problems should be, and some of them really are kind of, some of the resource allocation, resource use problems really are kind of insoluble in terms of a really perfect solution, in theory and in practice insoluble, but what it shows is you can get, a solution that's good enough And again, in a way that isn't just using prices, but is increasingly using lots of other, you know, types of information in order to plan and to come out with, you know, the best places to put warehouses, the best way to route couriers, the best ways to do, you know, XYZ. And again, things that calculation problems that should be really, really too vast to compute, but they get the solutions that are good enough. And the real value in Amazon is, you know, one, it's sort of cloud servicing, talk about that, but two is really the underlying, you know, it's not really the warehouses and things like that. It's really the underlying algorithms that are doing the background work. I mean, the other thing that Amazon shows, and again, it, you know, has in common with Walmart and with basically almost all capitalist enterprises, is that then it uses that same information technology to create, you know, increasingly dystopian working conditions. You know, if you think about an Amazon warehouse, this is starting to get to those levels where people aren't taking bathroom breaks. You know, there's ambulances parked outside on hot days. People are getting fired if they're not, you know, if they're not meeting these really draconian quotas. And again, it shows some of the problems of capitalist planning from the left perspective, in that, you know, we have some tools here that are useful, and that are useful to any project that would like to use planning to achieve social goals, but that would really want to transform it. You know, it's hard to think of someone, you know, voting themselves into the role of Amazon warehouse worker in the way that that looks currently.
Right.
Or whatever you want, you know, whatever democratic means you have for making decisions. But it's, you know, it is still a very top-down plan that ends up in this place.
Right. And when we talk about the exploitation of a Walmart or an Amazon, theoretically, right, that is, I mean, if you were to apply that to society at large, there wouldn't be that exploitation, which is born out of, like, sort of, I guess, a rentier class that, you know, shareholders needing to get their value from that worker. That doesn't mm-hmm. exist, right, when we talk about society writ large, because that value is shared amongst the workers, as opposed to the value created by those workers goes to the shareholders.
Yeah, that's right. And we have a set as a society, we have a different set of values, different set of sort of goals, rather than just profit maximization. So some of that might be more bathroom breaks, a longer weekend, a more relaxed pace of work, and the trade-offs of that compared to, say, producing more of a particular item. Or delivering it faster. Now, maybe we would want to, but we would at least be able to deliberate as a society which of these different targets we want to achieve. There's a multiplicity of them, rather than just a single target for shareholders, which is maximization of profit.
I want to come back to this question as to how we democratize. How does we'll get back around to that. That's really the question. Yeah. But Lee, while we're here, why don't we talk about the Soviet Union and you know, how planned economy functioned in the Soviet Union.
Well, one of the interesting things about the Soviet Union is that it was not planned straight out of the gate. If you look at the economic history of the Soviet Union, planning sort of came in fits and starts many, many years after the founding of the Soviet Union, often in response to bottlenecks or just the collapse of the economy. And it took a long time for even after during the Stalin counter-revolution to develop plans. The irony there is that the right will make the argument that one of the problems in the calculation debate was that because it's impossible for humans to replicate the army bureaucrats replicate the price signal, there will inevitably be shortages. Those shortages will result in chaos. That chaos will only be resolved through authoritarianism, and that's their explanation as to why the Soviet Union was authoritarian, i.e., planning led to the authoritarianism. If you look at the history of the Soviet Union, it's actually the other way around entirely. It's that the authoritarianism undermined the planning. And that's very simple, simply explained by the fact that, you know, if you're petrified of being shot or sent to the gulag, if you don't meet your particular target, you'll lie and say to your superior, oh, actually, we've met this target or we surpassed it. And so the information in the system is has a weaker fidelity to reality. So it's actually the other way around. It's the authoritarianism undermined the planning rather than planning leading to authoritarianism.
I think we're going to be talking to an author of a book about the cheating scandal at that school in Georgia, and the public schools in Georgia when they were under the gun about Race to the Top. I mean, it's a similar dynamic there, I guess, where you've got to hit certain benchmarks and the easiest way to attain those benchmarks is to lie about it. But is the idea that the argument that was made in terms of a critique was the idea that the planning led to the authoritarianism because the planning was so rigid
that humans would not be able to, or even computers would not be able to calculate or to represent information in the system in the same way that the price signal does. That it was simply impossible. Therefore, it would inevitably result in mismatches, in shortages.
And then you need the authoritarianism to maintain the chaos that came from the failure
exactly,
of the ability.
The chaos. Okay. Exactly. Okay.
So the argument that human beings don't have the ability, and we don't have machines that have the capacity to predict what the needs of the people will be and at what cost. And therefore, you will get subsequent to that, you will get chaos and you will get upheaval. And the only way to put a cap on that would be to have an authoritarian state to keep people in line, even though they are fundamentally feeling that their needs are not being met.
And it's a kind of fundamentally undemocratic argument in the sense of saying, you know, we don't, not just at this moment, but generally people do not have the capacity to be able to sort of make decisions over social life together. They either need, you know, according to that argument, you either get that kind of authoritarianism of the Soviet or you have to impose market relationships where there's a criterion that makes tons of, you know, totally irrational decisions. Like look at the production of fossil fuels, right? You get profitability that structures the behavior of everyone from capitalists to workers. And that's, you know, you sort of as society, you sort of hand over decision-making power to this other kind of, you know, blind criterion. And that, you know, as a matter of course, then also, and they don't say this part, you know, leads to all of these authoritarian workplaces as well, by the way.
Well, I mean, but that was sort of, I mean, they were back to Mount Pelerin, right? And to von Mises and von Hayek, where they're basically saying, like, look, somebody's got to be in charge. And we're the most competent people to be in charge, essentially. And so, you know, if the authoritarianism is going to come from us, it's going to be far more benevolent. As long as we, you know, we get our kickbacks, essentially. And so,
well, our kickbacks and humanity is so flawed that we have to bind ourselves to the mast, and we're going to do it with the market, and we don't actually trust ourselves, you know, as a collective to make decisions.
Absolutely. If you look at their arguments, and to this day, I know libertarians, you know, scratch the surface of them, and they will admit that they don't support democracy. They don't think it. They think that people are too stupid to self-organize And therefore, that is why we need markets. Markets are rational. It's fundamentally an anti-democratic philosophy.
Yeah, my sense is that the Mont Pelerin folks too were arguing that, you know, there'll be people like us who will also be sort of like guiding things just a little bit, and as long as we, you know, keep the control out of the hands of we don't want things to get too sovereign, as it were. But how do you then? How do you do that? Like, I mean, the examples that you're using when you talk about Walmart, when you talk about Amazon, Sears went awry, but a similar dynamic. It was just a wrong choice made by an individual, Sam Walton, theoretically. And I'm just using, I don't know who exactly would have made these decisions at Walmart, but couldn't the response to be like, yeah, well, Walmart, even as planned as that economy is, when we talk about Walmart as an economy, it was planned by non-democratic means. And there was goals that were set up that were very rigid and were very specific. Whereas if you were to open that up to democracy in some fashion, the goals would be more diffuse. And all of those elements that allow you to plan for a Walmart wouldn't be there because of the democracy. What's the response to that?
I mean, in many ways, that's the $1 million or million labor token or whatever you want to say question. I think it's, for me, one answer is simply the negative, that it is a bit weird for me to think that this means that we have now of ensuring that, you know, lots of sort of lower level individual decisions are somehow coordinated with higher level sort of social decisions, that this is the only or the best, maybe not the only, but the best and only possible, like, really long-term way of doing things, right? And that the cost of this, and we have massive irrationalities now. Again, I'll bring up the fossil fuels just because that is really the generational struggle, and that's a lot of this is a result of the kind of irrational production, the kind of incentives that that capitalism creates. I mean, we talk very briefly about Eleanor Ostrom in the book, who's the only woman to ever win the sort of fake Nobel Prize for economics, the Swedish central bank's prize. But she looked at sort of institutional designs. She pushed back on this idea of the tragedy of the commons, which is usually the thing that's kind of brought up as the background to this question, right? That if you leave it up to people to manage a common resource, and they all have, and it's this, you know, and they all have their own goals, and there's all these different things that they might want, you basically end up destroying that resource. And the typical example is that, you know, the pasture field for the village pasture field where everyone just gets their cows out to graze, you know, there's no price, there's no sort of a fee gate on it. And, you know, in a couple of years it's gone. Ostrom went back and actually looked at what did these institutions look like in practice. That's a very nice, you know, again, theory coming from the right. But what it actually looked like was that you had lots of different institutional designs and mechanisms and ways to basically generate incentives and generate behavior that aligned individuals with collective goals. And some of those might have been, you know, again, if we're thinking about 15th century England or whatever, some of these might not have been the best mechanisms. But the point is that humans have the capacity to draw up lots of different institutional structures, basically.
Right. Not everybody wants
to say what. Yeah. Not everybody wants to be
a cow shepherd, as it were. And some of those.
Or a cow shepherd, or if the cow shepherds sort of, you know, organize amongst themselves. And unfortunately, like I say, and at that time it was like, oh, if you overgraze, you're going to get ostracized from the village, right? It wasn't like if there is a $5 per day fee for grazing, and if you can't afford it, too bad.
Right.
you're not going to be able to be a shepherd. It was like, well, we're all going to have to somehow deal with this, and then you'll get, ostracized if you break it. Again, some of these might not be the best ways, but throughout history, we've had ways of dealing with these kinds of collective action problems. And it's kind of crazy to think that the way that subjugates all of our decisions to private profitability is the only like long-term feasible or desirable way to do this, that we couldn't decide. And we make decisions between different kinds of, of uses all the time, right. even though elections or whatever, we have some very limited forms of democracy, but they still are able to produce results where we're taking lots of different aims and somehow coming to an agreement.
let me ask you both this. I mean, if the People's Republic of Walmart basically makes the case that we now have the capacity to society to centrally plan, that it can be done, and theoretically the next book, right? I don't want to give you guys homework, but the next book is how do we set about not just assessing what society's goals are, but to implement that. It seems to me that the interim step is for people to have a certain awareness that these are political choices, right? Yeah. That these are all choices that we as a society can make, and we need to have that awareness that choices are constantly being made, so that we could then say, okay, and now we need to develop a democracy machine that will allow us to sort of set this agenda now that we have the tools to do it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the important thing there is the we, right? That, like, it's not going to come from somewhere on top, and it's not that there's now a machine that exists that we could, sort of take over, but it's something that we can co-create. And I like that. I mean, in some ways, we've literally made that joke that this is the first book, and that it opens all these questions for a second. And the way this first one is about calculation, and the next step is to talk about all these sort of coordination problems and all that. And that involves even more talking about that kind of bottom up democratic organizing that would be necessary to implement anything like this and to solve some of these problems. I think that we're still at that kind of baby steps stage, in the sense that our imaginations, as I said before, have been sort of so foreclosed that it's important to just say, there's lots of planning that already exists, and it's not so controversial an idea.
I would just add that already in society, however limited or constrained our democracies are, there's still enormous leaps over sort of previous feudal societies. Some countries are more democratic than other ones. There are, Iceland is a unicameral country. The United States has all sorts of semi-feudal carbuncles, like the Electoral College and the Senate. And, so already, even when we say that the next question is, well, what does that democracy look like? There are already in societies, there are better and worse versions of democracy. And we should sort of be building on those rather than imagining that something it has to be cut from entirely new cloth. It's about an extension of democracy from the political realm into the economic realm. And we already have some examples where that works so much better than authoritarianism.
I mean, do you think, are there any proposals that are being floated around now in the political discourse that you think also function in the same way to show that type of central planning is possible, obviously on a more limited scale, but that are in the mix that could be applied? Like, is single-payer healthcare an example of something like that?
I think it is. Yeah, I mean, especially in the American context, one of the chapters in the book is about the NHS, the National Health Service in the UK. The chapter is called Nationalization is Not Enough. So in some ways, it's a cautionary tale or a tale about how even the fact that something is, you know, state-run planning doesn't automatically excuse it from critiques of it not being democratic enough and not involving patients and workers in the actual co-creation. But it's a huge leap over what currently exists in the U.S., which is this kind of, you know, again, showing really the irrationality of a market-based system when it's applied to something like healthcare, where you have such big gaps in simple, you know, in just simple access to healthcare, where when the NHS was created, the first thing was to create this national system where at least people had access. And then in the 1970s, there were these interesting experiments that started to lay the groundwork for introducing more democratization. I won't go into it. You know, there's a few things that we bring up that opened the door to more sort of co-creation by workers and patients that were effectively shut down, you know, in the 80s and 90s, where you actually had a kind of idea as Lamper's in Sears applied to the NHS, where you had all these market relationships sort of imposed internally to the NHS, which, while being still a single payer system, now internally had all these sort of webs of contracts between producers and purchasers. And in the US, it would be a huge step just to get to that national system where you could say, again, it's not the insurance companies deciding who's going to get what care and the amount of money in people's pockets deciding about what kind of coverage and what kind of care they can get, but some kind of social process that takes all of this and again, takes all of that information and is able to make decisions in a different way.
Michal Rozworsky, Lee Phillips, thanks so much for your time today. We will put a link to People's Republic of Walmart, how the world's biggest corporations are laying the foundation for socialism, at the majority.fm website. Thanks again for your time.
Great to be here.
Thanks so much, Sam.
Fascinating interview. I'm going to read that book. I'm currently reading Bhaskar Sunkara's, of course, great new book. He's going to be on tomorrow.
I could be wrong, but I think that interview was one big long dunk session on von Mises and Hayek.
I think there were some broader ramifications of it, but yes.
Yeah, you can see the wheels turning in Sam's head. Like, I feel like he'd be a really good big government socialist.
Well, he's like, look, if getting rid of capitalism means an incredible savage talking point for disturbed young men that call this show to talk about deregulation, then God damn it, I'm a socialist. Hello. Oh, yeah.
That literally is just like a tree of a branch of the different libertarian sort of arguments, right? Like, central planning doesn't work. Well, what do you make of Amazon or Walmart?
Right. Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of ways in which it's a very potent argument, and I think true, that we're both in a different phase of capitalism in the sense of acceleration of environmental destruction, global supply chains. Like, it's very dangerous in terms of like future viability or even relatively immediate viability of human life continuing to exist. And then on the other hand, some of the conditions, if you flip them, particularly from global networks, really advanced centrally planned supply chains, the Amazon and Walmart, you have some of those conditions in place, actually.
Absolutely.
To transition to a post-capitalist economy.
We have the productive capacity to make everything that everyone in the world needs and distribute it democratically. The primary obstacles are, as usual, political.
Definitely. Folks, this Sunday, we're going to... Well, actually, I'm not sure what the illicit history is going to be quite yet for this Sunday. We're probably going to be doing something actually very Iran specific. So let me just point everybody back to Tuesday with Reniqua Allen and Ben Burgess. And all, if you want to get a sense, I mean, you can really at this point, I think, get a fairly, not all of the Patreon content, but you get a pretty good flavor of TMBS with all the clips that we have on the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. And of course, the best thing to do is become a patron, get all of the illicit histories and primers, get informed from Hegel to Jamaica. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we have special guest Katie Halper of the Katie Halper Show. to talk about the 90s, the politics of the 90s, and the culture of the 90s, and how a lot of those phenomena kind of prefigured what's happening now in our political world. She talks a little bit about her journalism, her interview with Juanita Broderick, liberal hypocrisy, along those lines with regard to Bill Clinton's transgressions alleged. And, you know, I mean, I believe Juanita Broderick, but you guys can make up your own minds about that.
Hashtag me too.
Hashtag.
Yeah. Also, we are doing a live show tomorrow, me and Katie, along with Struggle Session, Leslie Lee III.
Big Leslie Lee III fan.
He's
a big fan.
He is the man.
Great guy.
Jake Flores.
Does a great job.
Matt Taibbi and more. The other guy from Struggle Session. Oh my God.
Jack Allison.
Jack Allison, yes.
Got some hitters there.
Yeah, it's going to be so good.
Strong lineup.
At Littlefield tomorrow in Brooklyn at 8 p.m.
I saw a really cool tweet where an awesome guy who said, it was like before February, I had never been to a political show. Then I went to TMBS in Brooklyn. Then I went to TMBS in L.A. And now I'm totally convinced that this is really fun and I'm going to Littlefield.
Hell yeah.
So, there it happens.
We all rise together.
And I understand why generically you wouldn't be too excited to go to a political live show, but we actually make them super fun.
Oh, yeah. So and Struggle Session is very much based around pop culture as well. It's like pop culture from a leftist perspective.
It's a fun show.
Yeah, we're going to talk about all kinds of fun things that I definitely know what all of them are already.
Exactly. Live show mode. Matt, what's going on?
This weekend on the Literary Hangover, The Song of Hiawatha by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, or as I like to call it, Indian Jesus, because it's basically, if you look at it, it's a story of Native American Jesus type fellow who prepares his tribe to basically hand off the land to the white people. And we talk Jesus. About that as a sort of very popular poem and as problematic, and also too liberal for the New York Times at the time. Coming up, we're going to be doing some more George Orwell for patrons. The essay Such Were the Joys about his time at private school. That's in a couple weeks.
That's an amazing title.
Yeah, it's from a William Blake poem.
Because I'm assuming, yeah.
It's very, he's very
it was
unkind.
Like not a good experience.
It's Eaton that makes you a man.
Yeah, he
in
is,
a certain sense.
It's basically, it's not accurate factually at all. It's very, it would have been libelous if he printed it in his lifetime and he didn't. And we're also doing Margaret Fuller, who I don't know if either of you guys are familiar with her. She's sort of the first publishing feminist in America. She wrote Woman in the 19th Century. She was part of the she's part of the Transcendentalist sort of Concord set.
Yeah, she was part of the Concord scene.
And she later went to Europe during the 1848 revolutions, was the first female correspondent for a newspaper.
Wow.
Met Mazzini over there and became a socialist during that whole stuff in Italy. So
that's amazing.
Cool.
We'll be
that
doing her
really
as
dope.
Well. So.
Awesome. And of course, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Go to justcoffee.coop for all of your coffee needs and check out the sponsors. We'll see you in the fun half.